Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, July 26th, 2021. And today, our first hour will be a replay of an interview I did with Dr. Pat Ogden, who's the founder of Sensory Motor Psychotherapy. In the second hour, Jeannie and Michael will be here. Please enjoy this interview.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for joining us here today, and I greatly appreciate your taking the time. I realize you're squeezing this in. Can you start by telling us a little bit about what got you started in the work you're doing and what drives your passion for this work with traumas?
Okay, sure. Well, the work that I do is based in the body. It's called sensory motor psychotherapy, so we really look at how the body participate in the legacy of trauma and attachment wounds and systemic oppression and so forth. And I got interested probably as a child because my body was my resource. Like I was really active, and if I was stressed, I would go into my body and go running, go to the woods, go to the lake. So I think that was the beginning. I developed a strong confidence in my own body. In the early 1970s, I was working at a psychiatric hospital, and I was teaching yoga and dance. And what I found was that the patients who did both those classes seemed to get better. And that really piqued my curiosity about the role of the body in mental health and in healing trauma, because many of those patients were traumatized. And then it just started rolling from there. I met Ron Kurtz, who is the first person I had ever encountered who felt that the body could be an avenue to implicit memories, implicit beliefs, childhood issues that maybe we'd even forgotten. So that was a big influence. And I moved to Colorado with Ron, started studying all kinds of movement work and body work, and really kind of went out on a limb in a lot of ways in what I was doing, because I was very interested in helping people shift how they live in the body. And in the late 70s, I was an adjunct therapist for the clinic here at the University of Boulder. And the clients that were referred to me were clients who had all been traumatized. I didn't know that at the time because nobody was talking about trauma. They'd all been sexually abused, and they were sent to me because these women couldn't experience sexual pleasure. And everything that I had been taught didn't work with these women. They got more dysregulated. Sometimes they'd come back the next week feeling worse. And I was baffled because I was doing everything I thought the right way. And I started thinking, well, I'm just going to try to keep them connected to their bodies. I'm not going to go into strong emotions. We're not going to revisit the memories. We're just going to stay connected to the body. And they started getting better. At least they stopped getting worse. So that was a really big learning for me, it was long before people even started talking about trauma. So then I started my own school, started teaching, and
yeah. You just kind of learned as you went, huh?
I did learn as I went, and I studied a lot of alternative methodology, the Rolf method of structural integration, which works with alignment and posture in the body. It's a hands-on body work, and I studied all kinds of movement disciplines. So I really had kind of an alternative approach, and then I met Bessel van der Kolk in the mid-90s, and he's a premier trauma therapist, wrote an incredible book called The Body Keeps the Score, and he started introducing me to more traditional approaches and kind of integrating my work into that world. So since then, since the mid-90s, I've been working a lot with neuroscientists and attachment experts and people in the field of dissociation, learning how those fields really interface with my work with the body.
Yeah. Well, so you have this website, sensorymotor.org, and you train therapists in sensory motor psychotherapy.
Correct.
And people can actually go to your website, sensorymotor.org, and type in their location and find out if there's any therapists who've been trained through your organization that are relatively close to them. What's one of the primary things that you can tell us, or the people listening who might be thinking about wanting a therapist to work through some therapy, that separates the sensory motor psychotherapy approach from traditional talk therapy?
Primarily, what separates sensory motor psychotherapy from talk therapy is that a sensory motor psychotherapist is looking at how the body participates in the legacy of trauma and relational issues. So, for example, a traumatized client might have a posture like this, and they might be frightened, and they might live with that fear from their trauma. And so we know that we're going to have more success in helping them if they can shift how they live in the body, because as long as the shoulders stay like this, the fear is sustained. So we'll look at whatever the presenting difficulty is of the client. It's got to show up in the body, because we all have a body. Everything we experience is through the body. So no matter what the client comes with, we look at how the body reflects the issues. Many traumatized clients live kind of outside a window of tolerance. So they feel dysregulated, like anxious and hyper-aroused, or else just kind of deadened and hypo-aroused. So we want to work with the body with what we call somatic resources to help bring arousal into that window of tolerance where a person can be in the present moment. A friend of mine, Anno Vanderhart, coined the term trauma time, saying most traumatized clients live in trauma time, which means that it feels like the trauma is still happening. It's still impacting our day-to-day experience. And that's really disconcerting for a survivor.
Well, and as you mentioned a little bit earlier, you started this kind of work at a time when people weren't even really talking about trauma. And the more I've been exploring with different people and interviewing different professionals who do integrative or functional or holistic psychiatry or therapy or medical work, the more I'm hearing them say that they're waking up to the realization that many of the symptom patterns they're seeing are directly related to trauma, childhood trauma, and others. And so that's being talked about now far more fluidly and consistently than it was back in the 70s and 80s. Um, How has that changed what you do with people or training therapists, the idea that now it's getting to be more accepted?
It hasn't changed how we train therapists at Central Motor Psychotherapy Institute, but it has validated what we do. So the body is becoming more and more mainstream, working with the body to heal from the effects of trauma is becoming more and more mainstream. So we have a lot more visibility, a lot more therapists coming to study with us. But you know what you say about functional medicine and holistic approaches, looking at the effects of trauma. What I want to say about that is two very obvious ways to look at that is that when a trauma happens, you know, our arousal will shoot up really high to mobilize us to defend ourselves or to get away or to get help. And if that doesn't work, our arousal will just plummet to this deadened, shut down state. And for trauma survivors, those states of arousal are outside of that window of tolerance, and that compromises our immune system over time. So trauma survivors have a, you know, sequelae of physical issues that emerge from unresolved trauma. You know, another way to think of it is many childhood abuse survivors went into more of a collapsed, shutdown state. So the body's often collapsed and pulled in. And that becomes a habit, a habitual way of living in the body. And a posture like this is not good for our bodies. There's not room for the organs. We can't take a deep breath. It constricts the heart. You know, so all how we inhabit our body is not only related to psychological health, but our physical health. Yeah. So this strong connection.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, when we're in and in the studies of some of the cellular biologists like Bruce Lipton, recognizing that when you're in a stress state, mental, emotional stress state, that will override the physical signals to your body and your cells will start to go into that shutdown and protection mode, which means also if you have to run or fight for your life, you don't really need to worry about healing the cut on your hand. So the whole immune system shuts down because that takes a lot of energy. And if we live, as so many of us do, in that accelerated high stress or near fight or flight level, we're living in a suppressed immune system state, which leaves us so vulnerable, as you said, to this whole series of problems.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know,
go ahead.
Well, if I could say something about that, that's even more critical for people for whom the trauma is not over. Like many of my clients, they had trauma in childhood, now it's over, and they're relatively safe. But for a Black person, for example, you know, it can be dangerous just walking down the street. There's the constant threat of aggression, what can happen if you don't control your emotions and your body, if you're stopped by the police and so forth, you could lose your life. So for people who are marginalized, whether they're transgender or African-American or Asian, there's so many societal threats that are still ongoing that it's a challenge to bring the arousal quickly back into a window.
Yeah, and the wear and tear on our energy systems physiologically to be in that constant high stress state.
Right.
Is and of course there are some of those when you're actually in a war zone and your whole town, your whole community is in the war zone with you. People come together and there's a support that happens. But when we're living in these isolated apartments and houses and condos and we don't have that sense of community and we're living at that high stress level, there's just a whole series of factors that tear the energy system down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's really true. You know, they say that the the best inoculation against post-traumatic stress disorder is a secure attachment relationship in childhood, like where you have secure relationships, you can count on each other, and then when you're an adult, you know, if you do have trauma, you're much less likely to get PTSD if you have that foundation.
Wouldn't it be great if we could give that to more people?
I know.
Well, so, you know, there are so many ways that I would want to take a conversation with you, because you've been at this for so long, and there are so many different aspects of trauma work. One of the things I like to do with these discussions is help people who might either have a family member who needs a therapy or support for a trauma or a mental health challenge, or the actual individual who might be looking for a therapist. And so aside from looking at going to sensorimotorpsychotherapy.org and looking for a provider, what kinds of things would you tell a person who's looking for a therapist to help with trauma that he or she should be looking for in the therapist?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think first and foremost, you've got to trust your gut. If it's a good connection with the person, if you feel safe and confident in them, then half the journey is won already. You know, half the battle's won. I mean, I'm biased towards work with the body, because trauma first and foremost affects the body. It affects our arousal level, and it affects our somatic system as we prepare to protect ourselves and make ourselves safe. So if I were looking for a trauma therapist, I would look for someone who did understand the role of the body and incorporated some somatic approaches. Many clients are frustrated trying to resolve their trauma through insight, through cognition, because that's not where trauma first has its effect. When we're threatened, our instincts, our subcortical instincts, are mobilized for survival. For example, if you're taking a fall down the steps, you instinctively will grab for the railing before the signal that you're in danger gets to your thinking brain. And it's important to understand that with trauma, because it's hard to resolve it cognitively, and it's also hard to resolve it by expressing emotions related to it. One of my teachers who died the year I was born, so I never met him, is Pierre Janet, and he talks about what he calls vehement emotions, that the emotions connected with trauma can't be resolved by expressing them, because those emotions are designed to fuel our protective mechanisms. So you think of rage.
Exactly, right.
Like so many, you know, veterans that I've worked with have this uncontrollable rage that's associated with a fight response. And they've tried everything, you know, and they can't, often can't modulate it because it has to do with the subcortical impulses. You know? So I think I would look for somebody who had an understanding of the body's role in trauma, because I think there's the likelihood that you'd have more success working at the level where trauma first impacts.
I think as you're talking about Peter Levine and how he talks about his own trauma, trying to walk through a crosswalk and getting hit. It's like, who's the woman neurologist who had the stroke, you know, her stroke of genius. When you have somebody who's trained in that body of work and then they go through that problem themselves. So the analysis, that Peter Levine talks about, being aware of all his physical responses and the self-protective motions, and then the energies vibrating in his body, and being able to understand that he doesn't want to fight them off and he doesn't want to restrict them, and being able to stay aware of those energies, being able to work with somebody who won't try to get you to either shut down your emotions or spend a whole lot of time in your emotions if you're having a physical response. I think that's highly desirable in someone who's going to work with trauma, that they're able to see the whole energy system and be trained in the kind of thing you do at sensorymotorpsychotherapy.com or .org.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a story or two that you could share about someone who's really shifted with the sensory motor approach to psychotherapy?
Oh, there's so many stories. Any particular kind of client that you're interested in? I could talk about a veteran or an abuse survivor. Or I'll tell you a couple of stories, unless you have a suggestion.
We've done both of those recently, so either way you want to go.
Okay. Well, one rather dramatic shift that I'm thinking of was a client, I'll call her Tessa. And when she, this was a consultation client, her therapist brought her in, her therapist was there as well to do a consultation with me. And she had been a sex worker since she was 13 years old, had been abused all through her life, had been raped repeatedly. And she had, as she said, I have no worth. I have no value. She said, if a buck hit me tomorrow, nobody should mourn because I'd be better off if I'm not here, right? And the whole time that she was talking, she was, you know, her body was pretty tight, but there was this little motion of her fingers, like her hands were in her lap, but her fingers would come up like this every once in a while. And this is an important element in trauma therapy, because these little preparatory movements are often indicative of a larger movement that wanted to happen but couldn't happen. And, you know, we can imagine as a child and with all these times she's been attacked, that her pushing away and trying to defend herself was futile. It didn't help at all. So when I tracked that and I asked her to be aware of it, and I held a pillow against her hand, and it was as if some impulse ignited from within that she had completely abandoned, because it had only made trauma worse in the past. And she started pushing against that pillow. And, you know, when actions are being completed like that, there's a real sense of pleasure often. And she was, like, astonished at the force of the action and how good it felt in her body. But the thing that touched me the most was I asked her what it felt like, and tears started to come, and she said, it feels like hope, like maybe there's some hope. And it kind of ignited this faith in the future, that a future could be different from the past.
Potential for change, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think of that often with the body, because we all abandon actions when they were ineffective at producing the desired outcome. So, you know, if we weren't allowed to express ourselves, maybe we closed down. If you know, our caregivers didn't respond to our proximity-seeking actions, we stopped reaching out, and so forth. So hope really lives in the movement vocabulary of the body, and Tessa found that hope with that action, that was an instinctive action, but she had lost it through all her experience. So that's one client that I think about.
Which is just, you know, as I sit here listening to that, the potential that is opened up for her in tapping into that is endless.
Oh, yes, it is. And it is with any action, you know. I want to tell one other story because I think that this is important for people when they're resolving trauma. The problem with trauma is if we go into it, our arousal is going to get outside of the window really fast. So in sensory motor psychotherapy, we work with like a traumatic memory step by step. For example, one veteran that I worked with who was frontline combat, when he thought about the memory, he started to get anxious. And if I had said, well, tell me more about the memory now, his arousal would have just continued to shoot up. So instead, I said, okay, what would help your arousal come into that window? And he placed his hands on his torso, and we just stopped until his arousal settled, right? And so we just stayed with this. I did it with him, and his arousal started to settle. And then we went on to the content. And I think this bottom-up way of working with the body is because the content, like retelling, is reliving to some degree. And by retelling, we'll stimulate those unmetabolized responses in the body. So with this client, the first one was the arousal and his hands and our paws calmed it down. The next one was he said he felt like somebody was shooting at him and his hands came up and he wanted to make his body wanted to do a pushing motion. So again, we stopped and just allowed that action, right? And we have to remember that we're always working with the effects of all the trauma because we'll develop patterns of response in our body. So somebody might say, well, why do you do that action when his memory is about somebody shooting at him? That's not going to protect you from a bullet. But the threat mobilized that response, and so then we just trust his body, right? And so we did that action. He settled. The action felt good to him. Then we went on with the content, and then he started trembling and shaking. And that was a moment where we wanted to put all the memory aside and, again, just go with his body and feel the trembling, let it sequence through his body, trusting that his body will process that if we can just stay with it, which it did. It's like it had this bell curve where it got stronger and then it settled. And, you know, that one session of reworking the traumatic memory, I remember he said after that, he said for the first time in years, he could talk about what happened because we metabolized the leftovers in his body, the impulses and the sensations.
Yeah, I first encountered that really important pattern that you're discussing there in Babette Rothschild's book, The Body Remembers, and paying very close attention to the physical arousal and just stopping everything and helping the person experience that and find a way to get settled again before moving on. And it was one of the more effective pieces of working with people because then I wasn't pushing against anything.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to push them into some kind of resolution. I was allowing them to back away from whatever would feel threatening and experience this energy. And it wasn't until years later that I learned the kind of thing you're talking about, where actually picking up those little cues about motions and letting them move through them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's so often when we do that with people, it helps them let the mental emotional connections they need to see come to the surface, because now they're not in that fight or flight where they're locking everything down.
Well, see, that's an important thing, because through these kinds of somatic interventions, arousal does come into that window, and then other elements can come into awareness. But, you know, it's tricky for a trauma therapist, because if you stay right in the middle of the window, you're not going to stimulate dysregulated arousal and truncated actions. So we have to work at the edge of that window. But with a trauma someone is traumatized, there's a danger of really exacerbating dissociative tendencies and dysregulation. So it's really an art.
Well, especially, as you said, if the person wasn't raised in a nurturing environment and didn't internalize that sense of safety and competence. And,
right.
So, you know, the whole thing about developing resources within a traumatized adult, helping them realize that they can be stronger and more consistent and more present for themselves than they have been in the past is just a whole powerful set of tools to have as a trauma therapist.
Yeah, it is. And that sense of being present for yourself, again, it's a lived sense in the body. Like, what does that feel like, you know? I mean, it is different for everybody. But we want to get that somatic sense of nurturing and care for yourself. And yeah.
So is there another story that you want to share where someone has made a significant shift just from the sensory motor work?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Well, I'm thinking of a woman who was really severely traumatized, severe abuse all through childhood, had a dissociative disorder. She couldn't feel her body at all. She was alexithymic, couldn't feel her emotions, couldn't feel her body. And she said to me, well, I know that I'm sad because tears are rolling down my face, but she said, I don't feel anything. It's just the tears rolling down. And she wanted to feel. The reason she wanted to feel was that it was because she had a little boy who was, I think, 3 at the time of this work. And she said, I don't want to go through my whole life not having him because I don't feel anything for him. And she would do this exercise where she would touch her son's finger and she would say, okay, there's all this love in my heart coming through my arm down into my finger and then it's going into your finger and going all the way up into your heart. And she said he could really feel it, but she said, I feel nothing, felt nothing. So we started working with a positive experience because often a positive memory can be safer for a person to start to feel their body. So she felt herself, she remembered riding her bike when she was little and the wind in her hair, and it felt so good. She said it's like freedom, and her body shifted a little bit from this posture to this posture. But then, as often happens, it was coupled with the horror of her childhood. And one of the worst, most painful things for her was that the only beings that she was attached to were the animals on the farm. Everyone in her family abused her. She was the only girl, brothers, father, mother, they all abused her. She was remembering losing all her friends. One by one, they were slaughtered. And she said her heart was broken, just broken. And so I asked her if she could bring her hands to her heart and just, because she protected her heart with all this tension, if she could protect it that way. And she did it. And for a moment, it felt warm and safe, but only for a moment. And then she took her hands away and she said, my brain's shutting down. I'm going to in a shutdown mode. And she was right on the brink of hyperarousal, about to shut down. And it's so interesting because when we're working with somebody who's severely traumatized, there are kind of different parts of the self that hold the trauma. And another part of her is coming up that was terrified of any kindness towards herself. So we practiced movements. I remember she made a movement to keep the memories away because she was getting really overwhelmed. But we kept coming back to this motion, and gradually she could stay a little longer and a little longer and a little longer. So we're working here with complex trauma where there's abuse, but there's also relational, severe relational failure, attachment failure, right? And in our work, she was learning to also bring some compassion towards herself, as well as with some of the other interventions of sequencing the hyperarousal, making actions that felt safe. And I remember after our work, she said, you know, for the first time, it feels like I really did something. She said, all the other therapy was just talking, but this time I did something. But, you know, body therapy, like all therapy, it's not without risk. And for her, the work we did broke through her alexithymia. And she started to have pretty strong emotions coming up, and which, you know, can be a little dysregulating in and of themselves. But she said, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and she could begin to process those emotions. And the most gratifying part is that she could start to actually pick up her son and hold her son. And that was very satisfying, of course. So that's another story.
Excellent. Excellent story. And, of course, I'm grateful that you say that, you know, when you do this, it contains risk, right? I'm going to access things that are very intense,
yeah,
that some part of my mind has decided it's not okay for me to know, and it's been keeping separated from my conscious awareness for years, if not decades.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very important in my experience, and I'm frequently recommending this to people, to work with somebody who's specifically trained in trauma work, not just a good new technique that they've learned.
Yes, definitely.
Conceptual framework about the person, the whole mind-body energy system, the awareness that everything that we've done and all the symptoms that we've accumulated at one point or another were adaptive. They were there for some kind of a reason.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I can honor that reason and I can be working with a therapist that understands that and isn't just trying to strip all the symptoms away, and then there's a much better chance that I'll move in a somewhat more straight line towards resolution, as opposed to opening up Pandora's box and then shrieking and running and recoiling even further into my rigid symptoms.
Right. And there's a risk of that with body therapy. And I like what you said. We always teach our students that every symptom, every part, every action, it does have a subconscious purpose, period. But many people who work with the body, there's a risk of failing to attend to how different movements and different postures reflect the part of the self. For example, I can give so many examples. For example, we often work with proximity-seeking actions, just simple reaching out, which if you didn't have an attachment figure there for you as a child, it's hard to reach out to others, right? But if you're asking a client who was abused by their caregivers to practice that action, it's going to stimulate another part of them that's rooted in defensive responses. And that we have to be aware that we don't override one part for another. You know? So if we're practicing that action, we could ignore and override the part that's so frightened of it. And even with posture, like I was working once with the woman who was suicidal and her posture was so collapsed, and that just enforced her despondency, right? So the impulse was to help her find her alignment and feel better. But what does that do? That pushes this part that wants to kill herself underground, and then it can come up even more strongly. So we worked with sensing the part that was so despondent and slowly coming up only to the point where she still felt connected to that part, not to the point where that part was overridden. And I think this is so critical in working with the body, to pay attention so that our somatic work doesn't override a part of the self, especially when clients are at risk or dissociative.
Yeah, exactly. And there are so many good, solid, I'll say, therapy models, internal family systems and coherence therapy and a variety of others, too many to mention, that acknowledge the implicit emotional knowing and corrective or protective measure that underlies all of the symptomatology. And if we can honor that and help the person understand it, then we get an integration, we get better feedback for the whole system, and we get an adult who is more capable in the moment to do what's best for that adult.
You know, it's so interesting because the buzzword for trauma, like you're saying, is integration. To really be able to integrate the past, integrate the parts of the self, integrate the emotions and the actions and all. Because I'm trained as a Rolfer, you know, I really look at somatic integration as well, like helping the body find its alignment with gravity and its integrative movements, which really opens up possibilities for people. So for me, the integration of mind and dissociative parts goes hand in hand with also the integration of the body and the access to a wide movement vocabulary.
And the access to the information that those physical tensions and postures and emotions carry. It's really valuable information.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Ron Kurtz used to say that if we help enough of the right kind of information come from the inside of the client to consciousness, then the system will automatically reorganize towards health. And I think that's true. When I learned to be a therapist in the 70s in the prison where I was a counselor and the psychiatric unit and even social work school, I was expected to have the answers for people. And it was a huge relief to learn that people have their answers inside and they have that capacity to heal inside themselves. So all we have to do is help them become aware of it. And it sounds like it's simple, but it isn't. It takes a lot of observational skills and, you know, training and everything else to really help people find that wisdom. Yeah.
Well, but as you say, the first step is to recognize that it's not me who has to come up with that answer. It's the person who has it within them.
Right.
And if I can, so that's a huge burden lifted off of me as the therapist to begin with.
Yeah.
As long as I can get my ego out of the way. And then the tools and the willingness to help that person explore themselves and their history and their internal implicit emotional knowings. That's truly the key for success in my experience.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a big kind of paradigm shift in my work that is veering away from talk therapy is that we, in sensory motor psychotherapy, and Ron introduced me to this as well in the 70s, we're much more interested in patterns of internal organization than we are in the content and the history. What we want to work with is how the person organizes their experience inside right this moment through their body sensation, their movement, the images that come up, the emotions, and the thoughts. And this is where, instead of having a conversation and talking about things, we work a lot with mindfulness. And I want to say, you know, I've been teaching and working with mindfulness since the 70s, but it's only in the last several years that I've become aware of how Western culture has appropriated mindfulness from Eastern traditions. And I just want to acknowledge that, because in that process of appropriation, the true original meaning and practice of mindfulness has really shifted. So I want to acknowledge and express appreciation for the traditions that it comes from. But through mindfulness, we can be aware of our organization. Yeah? So if somebody is talking about being raped as a child, instead of just talking about it, you know, we would ask, okay, so if you're talking about it right now, what starts to happen inside? Well, I feel I'm pulling back. I'm starting to feel scared. I have this thought, I'm never going to be safe. You know, I have this image of this rapist and his eyes. And that's the organization of experience. You know? It's not a conversation anymore at that point. And that's where change can really happen, is when we shift how we organize experience. Like clients will say after the work, things like, yeah, the rape happened, you know. And they won't have this, they'll organize around it differently. That's why the veteran could talk about the combat, because he organized differently. Yeah.
Yeah, great, great stuff. The whole idea that I don't get to change my past, but I can absolutely change what I've made it mean about me and my life. I can reorganize it so that it has a whole different meaning.
Yeah, you can reorganize your internal response. That's right. Absolutely.
Well, I thank you so much for this time. I realize that we're pushing the limits here because I have something else I got to go do. But can you think for a minute briefly if there's something that I haven't even asked you about yet that you wanted to make sure to share with our listeners, either a new project you have going or... I mean, book you're writing.
Well, I do have a new book coming out. It's called Sensory Motor Psychotherapy in Context. And it's really looking at how psychology itself was created by Europeans of Christian and Jewish ancestry for people of that population. And that has really permeated psychology. Our methodology has not been adapted to include other voices, and the emphasis of a Western approach, say, on research, well, it silenced other very valid ways of knowing from indigenous people and other traditions. So I am really excited about looking at systemic oppression and marginalized groups, and the whole concept of privilege oppression dynamics, and trying to, you know, really, I feel a very strong moral responsibility to do my part to try to participate in making the world more equitable. And that includes addressing all the implicit bias that we grew up with, including about the body, and bringing a more equitable lens to our work as therapists as well.
As you say that and talk about that book, it makes me think about the book, My Grandmother's Hands. Have you heard about that book?
Of course. Rasmus Manikin.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to reading your new book when it comes out. I'm grateful beyond words for your sharing your time with us. I would... consider it an honor if you'd let us talk to you again after the book comes out.
Yeah, of course. This has been a pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And be well until we get to talk again.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you.
Take care.
Welcome to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. And today is Monday, July the 26th, 2021. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And yes, we're starting a little early. Dr. Tim had sent me a note and said that his interview with Dr. Pat Ogden from the Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute wasn't but about 47 minutes long. So we are starting our second hour just a few minutes early. So welcome. And that was interesting to listen to Dr. Ogden's perspective, and it's a lot in line with what we teach. So if you didn't get a chance to hear it, then please tap into the archives when the show's over, and you can listen to what that interview was all about. And so welcome, Michael. Hello? Michael, you're on. I hear
awesome.
You breathing.
I love to breathe, for sure.
And I think you just disappeared. So I don't know if you are talking and don't realize that you have disconnected, or if it's your microphone or your speaker. I'm going to walk in the other room and see. You're disconnected. Oh, okay. So who's getting back in? So I'll direct you to our website, which is www.whyagain.org. And you can click on the start here or the bullseye in the middle of the page. Either one takes you to the same place. And that's where you can tap into all of the worksheets. You can go to the reality management worksheets, all the other worksheets that we have for the other workshops. You can also listen to MP3s of special radio shows that we've pulled out where we've walked someone through doing a worksheet. And if you're ever listening to one of the archives and it's not in our special shows and it's one where we have walked someone through doing a worksheet, please drop me a line at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org, and let me know which date it was, and I'll be sure and pull that one out and put it in with their special shows, because that helps, especially, you know, not just new people that aren't familiar with the work, but all of us, you know, to go back through and listen and to follow along with the worksheet and, you know, step by step how to do the forgiveness work. So it always helps to hear another person's, you know, as they walk through their work and do the worksheet and to say, oh, okay, and recognize the difference between, you know, your feelings, your emotions, and your thoughts that are behind it. Sometimes we get those mixed up, and also how to focus your goal to being specific to what you're doing the worksheet on. A lot of people will be doing a worksheet on, say, Billy Joe, and they get down to the goal and they want the world to be a better place. Well, that doesn't have a whole lot to do with Billy Joe, maybe a little bit, but you've got to narrow it down. I want Billy Joe to be nice. I want, you know, or whatever. You want to get more specific and not so general, and then you'll be able to see the shift, see what lies beneath it. Michael, are you back with us?
I am, sweetie. Thank you.
All right.
Technology, what fun it is. And welcome, everybody. Glad you're here today in Bristol, Virginia. We've got cloudy, hot weather. Just been out working in the garden a little bit. Awesome days. And let's go right to the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? We're in the chapter on transitions, chapter 15, if I remember correctly. And we're on page 91 if you're following along with us. Remember that you cannot order the book from us. We do not have it in stock anymore. It's out of print. However, if you go to Amazon or eBay, they've got lots of used copies for sale. So our book is out there, so it's still available. And you can go to the website and download the book free from our website. It's a PDF. You can just go to the picture on the homepage of the book, click on it, and drill down, and you'll find a copy of the book in many, many different languages. So you're welcome to download it free. And we're talking about transitions. We're talking about what it takes to move from the sympathetic dominant state of fear, flight, fright, fear, freeze, and move into a state of thriving. And so Richard's been talking about how he really took advantage of the fact that he got to play the victim. And by playing the victim,
you know, he could seem to stay in control, and that was better than simply being lost in his pain. So he's just sharing that this was a mechanism he's realizing. This being in control was a mechanism for avoiding his sadness. And so I'm going to offer the thought and break into his train of thought. Richard, notice that the better you get at proving you're right, the more alone you are. The need to be right and to control, as with violence and gossip, usually come from insecurity. Guilt and blame are not really crutches that assist your life, but rather are a ball and chain that hold you back. They're energies that are, quote-unquote, off the mark. And if you remember from our chapter on sin, the word sin in Aramaic is an archery term that simply means off the mark. And so earlier, when we were talking about your mom, we established that people felt driven away by you. When those people left, you felt like a victim. You are only a victim of the results of your own behaviors. The insights Richard gleaned from doing his work were the fruit of his willingness to look at his own painful realities and would change his life forever. He was experiencing firsthand that it was safe and healing to face himself. The change in him was visible. His posture became straighter and his voice deepened. He was in transition from victimhood to empowerment. And the key thought that finishes this chapter on transitions out is give yourself the opportunity to think new thoughts and test out new behaviors that will come about as a result. And so tomorrow we'll step into chapter 16, Healing Abuse and Victimhood. And we're delighted that you're here to be part of this conversation as we move forward in deepening the understanding of first century Aramaic forgiveness. Some of the most powerful tools on the planet were delivered 2,000 years ago in the ancient Aramaic language. Unfortunately, now this man Yeshua, if he sat in most places where they purport to be speaking about his teachings, he'd say, that's all Greek to me, because those Greek translations are a distant shadow of what he actually offered to people as his teachings. And so our effort and our work has been to go back to the original translation work that was done from the Kabur's manuscript, goes back to the early 70s, where 25 of the world's top Aramaicists worked on bringing forward the first century meanings of his words. And since then, we've worked diligently to decode the how-to portion. You remember that most of the Greek translations brought forward the belief that, well, there's nothing you can do, you just have to believe. Well, if you go back to the man Yeshua, he tells you there's plenty you can do. But the how-to has not been decoded very well by the Greeks. What we've worked on is decoding those teachings, and in particular, the forgiveness process that comes out of the first century Aramaic language. And in that language, forgive doesn't mean I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me. Forgive means I'm going to go inside myself and remove what doesn't belong inside of me. Remove the energies that are off the mark, literally removing my own sin. So the idea of being forgiven for your sins is crazy in the context of the first century Aramaic forgiveness process. Nothing whatsoever to do with being forgiven for your sins. It is the act of removing your energies that are off the mark that is forgiveness. So hostility, fear, sadness, grief, rage, drama, and trauma removed leave human life, leave us in that state of the active presence of love that we are designed for as human beings. So we're looking to establish an understanding of those tools and then bring them into full expression, bring them into full availability. And when you start moving through and getting rid of the hostility and fear-based non-being self, you end up with the presence of human life. You end up with an expression that instead of looking like angry and chintzy and sad and afraid, you end up with a state of being that no matter what somebody else is doing is abundant, is generous, is merciful, is all-embracing, is accepting, makes allowances, is gracious, civil, is able to compromise. And so they're the attributes that go along with the presence of love. You go back and you look at Paul and you kind of get a sense of Paul's issues when you read that piece that many talk about as being so beautiful. And you start to see his issues when you look at his speech, because he tells you everything that love is not. Oh, it doesn't envy. It doesn't anger. It goes through this whole list about what isn't. And you can tell by the speech what issues need to be resolved. And you can tell why Paul in particular says, why is it? You know, he's just can't get it. He doesn't understand it. Why is it the things I would do, I cannot do? And the things I hate are what I do. He didn't understand what forgiveness meant. He didn't understand that forgiveness was about removal of those attributes that keep us locked into the non-being mind. And when those attributes are removed, they make room for truly the active presence of love, which is human life. And so we're honored to be with you today. And Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
It is all quiet on the home front. There are no hands up, no questions in the chat room.
So well, if you're out there in listener land, go ahead, Jean.
I was just going to say that since we've got lots and lots of time and nobody's got a hand up, I understand what's going on, but I'm going to share and you add in, just so our listening audience understands. You know, if you've been listening to the show, then you know that Michael and I have been doing a lot of work with each other, doing a lot of breathing and inner processing and everything for the last, since January, February. I guess we started the year out with this. And
Since that second codependence intensive.
Yeah, yeah. So then I had my regular yearly checkup that I do every year, and they did blood work, and I actually have to go back tomorrow to go over the results with them. And I'm holding the space that, you know, our physician here is very naturopath. He understands this work. He actually, when he wrote a book, he quoted Michael in it. And so I'm sure that they're going to listen, but just hold the space. Because what's happened is that my blood work came back that what the medical field would call hyperthyroidism, and that all of my numbers for my thyroid are really, really high, except for the there's one TSH, and it's really low. And I think what's happened is that most of my life I was hypothyroidism, holding things and locking in. And, you know, I've talked about my throat and feeling like it was closed off. And my grandmother used to say it looked like I had a goiter. And then with the physical abuse and everything of my first marriage, you know, locking things down again, and the fear, and then the anger, but not expressing the anger necessarily, but holding it in. And that now that I've been doing this work and breathing and looking at those things that I've, you know, shut down for 50 years, and now my thyroid's active and working. And of course, I have consciously been wanting and working at releasing weight since the beginning of the year, and have done so. And they're going to say that that goes right along with it. So you want to add to that?
Well, my first thought was to recognize that back in January when you had your blood work done, you were hypo. Your thyroid was low. And if I were to rate it on a scale of 1 to 10, when the stress is up and the chips are down and anger is up for you, I would say that in the last 6 months, you've gone from maybe when there was a lot of stress going on, maybe a level 6 or 7 in anger to a level 1, like mega major work that you've done in that arena. And if you look at the chart on the physiological effects of emotional suppression, you'll see that what tends to shut the thyroid down is suppressed anger. And so you've gone from a non-functional thyroid, hypo, to hyper, to where it's high. And my offering would be that now that you've let loose of that layer, your thyroid's kicking in and going, oh man, I can work again. And yes, it's high because it's going to, and if we watch over the period of the next 2 years, I bet you dollars to donuts will watch your thyroid just level out right at perfect function. And so you're right on track with that. And those huge layers of sadness and anger that you have allowed to surface and allowed yourself to really feel and be with and forgive, it's like monumental piece of work, and your blood work is just tracking right along. I was saying the other day, it'd be nice if we had our own lab here that literally day by day by day, as each piece of work is done, if it would be awesome to have the facilities to be able to track exactly what's happening with the markers in the structure, with enzyme activities and chemical changes in the structure. It would be nice to have that facility, but you're right on track, sweetie, and I'm delighted for you. It's awesome. And delighted for me, too.
And it just goes to show, you know, we talk about it all the time, but how, you know, the mind, the emotion, the mind, the mental, the physical, everything is connected, and what impacts one impacts the other. And how, you know, tissue just holds on to stuff. It's the carbon-based memory, and things are locked in, even generational. And it may be unconscious level, but it still is impacting us physically. And how, when doing our work, that can go back to health.
Yes, and speaking of generational, maybe it would be cool to share when we were driving out to Missouri, that place where you were getting really fatigued and really tired, and what happened.
Yeah, that was really, it was, you know, Michael's,
powerful.
It was, and it just like snuck up on me. But Michael's foot was bothering him, so he was actually sitting in the back seat and had his foot up on the console between the two front seats and was keeping it elevated. So I was driving, and I had been driving for a couple, 3-4 hours, I don't know, and was starting to get tired, but, you know, wanted to allow him to keep his foot up and get it back to normal. And he was resting. And so I didn't wake him or anything. And I thought to myself, and it was real strange because it was in present tense. I said, I ought to call Mom, because always before, when I would drive, if I got tired,
breathing with you,
I would call her and she'd talk to me.
Yeah. And so Jeannie said, I ought to call Mom.
Yeah.
And immediately woke up when it came out of that tired state. Mom showed up, and she was wide awake.
And it was like, she did wake me up. Even, and for those of you who may not know, my mom passed away in September 2017. So, but for it to be so present, it wasn't that. If I was in this state before, I would have called her. It wasn't a past. It was absolutely, I need to call her. And so it just totally woke me up. And then right after that, there were two bridges back to back that were phenomenal. And I love bridges. And so it's almost like a blessing after that wake up. And about that time, then Michael woke up, and I was crying. And so he said, let's pull over and talk about what's going on. And so we did. And then I was able to continue driving the rest of the way without being tired. that was just, it was definitely, you know, like she was still speaking to me, like she was still here.
She is. Fully there for you.
Yep.
And sweetie, you know, one of the challenges you've been having for a couple of years now has been blood sugar and the thing that the energy, in the same way that anger tends to overlay the thyroid, sadness and grief overlay the pancreas and create dysfunction. And you've been having some challenges, on the edge of challenges with sugar. And I suspect as you process this grief and let loose of it, that like your thyroid, your pancreas is going to punch in full time, and that'll be the end of those blood sugar challenges.
Yeah, well, in the same blood work that I just had done, my A1C was good. My cholesterol was good. All of that had gone back into the right place. And so it's just my thyroid that's crazy.
No, your thyroid isn't crazy. Your thyroid, with all the changes that you've been doing, your thyroid's kicking back in and doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's seeking for its new norm. You know, it was way down, like, low to the point of a problem 6 months ago, the work that you've done to lift that anger off of your body, and now it's up high seeking its balance. And you watch, it'll balance out, and you know, and it's going to take time. It might be a year to 2 years till it balances out, but you watch, your numbers will be absolutely perfect. So you're
and,
right on track.
The anger, and you might explain how the anger and the grief and the fear, that the anger is just a cover for the other two.
Yes. Yeah. And you could, anybody wants to take a look, you can go to our website, whyagain.org. And there is a chart. If you go to the area where there are worksheets and you search for the chart, it's called the physiological effects of emotional suppression. And we show what emotions and what the correlating thoughts are to those emotions that shut down each organ in the endocrine system. Anger being thyroid and grief being pancreas. And so as you start to move those things through, and anger, of course, is an anesthetic. It's always a drug to cover some kind of pain. And when we cover it, we lock it into tissue. The idea here is to open it up and free it from tissue and let forgiveness happen. So nice work, powerful. But take a look at that chart, the physiological effects of emotional suppression. And you'll see.
And I'm putting the link to that in the notes for today as well.
Perfect. Awesome. And so if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our calling number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you're listening to the show. And if you push 1, we'll be having a conversation. She will introduce you by your area code, and we'll be saying hello. So how can we support you if you're out there in listener land? What's on your mind? What do you need support with? Are you using the forgiveness tool? You know, it's interesting how many people talk about and are so excited about the use of these tools when they start to understand what can happen. But then when they have to face, when they start to face what needs to be moved, unfortunately, that's the time when a lot of people turn tail and run. And it's the very time to turn right into the work and go deeper. But it takes time to build the brain cells. So how can we support you? What's on your mind? We've got 45 minutes. We started the show early today. Dr. Tim had a little shorter show today.
We have a hand up.
We've got lots of time for conversation. Great. Let's say hello.
It's area code 480. You're on the air.
480. Give us a name. Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Cecilia again.
Well, hey there, young lady. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing okay. Friday, the show was like gung-ho. Not gung-ho. I didn't feel gung-ho to do the work on what time in my life have I felt frozen. Okay. So to deal with my voice issues, that I have to do that. I mean, I don't have to do that work, but I really want to do the worksheets and go back and recall and do worksheets on it. And over the weekend, I felt like totally like I can't even. It felt like lead weight trying to even pick up a piece of paper, and my brain was just.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, the door wasn't open in my head about what these issues are or how to even write them down. I want to take it from there, so I really would like a little help from you. But I did this morning. I was, again, walking around like somebody pacing the floor, you know, like pacing. How can I do a worksheet? What's a frozen thing that I froze to? I'm stuck. And I decided... I don't know if that's the word I want to use, but I looked on your website and your archives for the word frozen. I found one radio show. Actually, I was on that radio show earlier. But at the end of the radio show, you had 3 minutes, and you talked about incarnation, the idea of incarnation. And that most of us, I wrote it out, come into the world as the into a genetic bloodline that had all kinds of fear, rage, et cetera. And then over time, the carbon-based memory that's stored in the physiology comes online. It becomes too traumatic to stay in your body. And one of the objectives of your work is to remove that trauma. Okay, that's what I'm trying to do. But Michael, this is like all the words down here of what we come into, and I'm just making it a intuitive guess that everyone comes into this kind of energy. And there's probably, I don't know, maybe there are people that don't come in with some of this, most of this energy. But I came in with all of the above, and so
right.
So where I start, the questions that stop that I feel about the question Friday of you asking me, what's the memory of you freezing? And it was supposedly my mother. I mean, I'm saying supposedly. Yes, I froze when she just verbally lashed into me, and a young age. But I look at this list, and I don't even have to look at this list because it's like my mind is on overload, overwhelmed. There's so many. It's so deep. It's so whatever that. And I did that. I feel like, you know, your goal management thing. You go into paralysis, or you have to cancel goals because. You've got too many goals going on there of what maybe I have too many goals to figure out what to really I can write on about areas where I became frozen, abused in my life. And yet I wanted to say that I did choose to write about my mother, but I couldn't get to too much even written down. I don't know what's going on with me. I feel like I'm an iceberg, and I have to, that's it. I didn't think about being frozen and then saying that. But I'm an iceberg that's got to fall a little bit at a time here to really even do a worksheet on it.
Right.
And
yeah, you've
got
to give yourself, be gentle with yourself and give yourself the space. Because when you start to open those doors, you're talking about huge pieces of work. And they don't happen in an instant. They don't happen overnight. And one of the things that occurs when those kinds of issues start to open and we start to look is that we just go blotto in the face of it, just go unconscious, like I don't even know what's happening here. And that's a stage of undoing, is unconsciousness.
Okay.
And so be patient with yourself. You know, I don't know if you've ever used drugs or alcohol, but if so, then those things reinforce unconsciousness, and they're part of what needs to be processed out of the system to move forward through those issues. And it takes time.
I've been sober for 30-something years.
Congratulations. That's pretty awesome.
But would that be... And I don't do drugs or anything. Would that be still stored in my system? Since there's this word called dry drunk, and when you don't work on your processing your emotions, then that's called dry drunk. Is that what
right.
we're talking about? Yes.
Literally, okay. Literally, when we hold the breath and we go into dissociation,
yes,
we create. Let's say energetic patterns, energetic anomalies, so to speak, that literally include, if not actual, like let's say if it was alcohol, literal molecules of alcohol that are locked in with those emotions. And if not literal molecules of alcohol, then the energy signature of alcohol. And when you start to reopen those things, the sensations of drunkenness, the sensations of unconsciousness are part of what needs to be processed out of the system. Mm-hmm. And when we're processing them out, we tend to go unconscious.
Okay.
Like, I don't even know what I'm doing here. Well, I know I'm working on something, but, you know, I just can't think. I can't remember. I'm just so confused. That's all part of the healing process. Remember the symptoms of healing on a physical level. Looks like any kind of physical symptom you've ever had and low energy. On a mental level, looks like any kind of negative thought you've ever had and confusion. And on an emotional level, looks like any kind of negative feelings you've ever had and depression. That's what healing looks like. As you open up and you start to process those things out, the key is to stay in the effort of keeping love present as you allow those things to surface and allow yourself to process through it.
So this is interesting. To keep love present, I've never experienced this much grieving in I think my entire life of the exercise
right.
that I'm doing of the connected grieving. This morning, I was standing up by my computer, looking at radio shows, trying to find them where it's frozen. And as I'm doing that, I'm also focused on my breathing. I'm staying connected to it, what I understand connected to at this level. And I could actually feel that's all I was doing. I mean, I felt like I was on a boat, and on the boat was the water was your shows. And I was just floating over them with my finger. And I'm on a boat, and my breathing is just the wind on the sails, and it, and I've never felt connected to my breath like that before, conscious of it, and either. So why I'm saying this is because I think I have to learn how to stay connected to love first before I can go in deeper. So
it is a process.
So the breath.
It is a process, and you're in the process.
Yes. Yes. So I'm there, and I don't know, I have some kind of something in me that thinks I needed to have this done Friday, this worksheet or something. I don't know. You know, I don't know. That's probably the part of me that wants to sabotage me because I didn't get it. I didn't get it and overcome the whatever, the frozenness because of that particular time. And I think it's unrealistic expectations that I have of myself in a lot of areas of life. So anyway, I'm sure I just brought up another worksheet or more when you said that. I guess my point is, yes. I also want to ask you, I also believe that the disease, I have periodontal disease, and I had x-rays last week, and I'm going to hear from the doctor tomorrow to see if my bone in my mouth is regenerating from 3 months ago or 2 months ago when you called me and I told you I thought I had COVID, but it was actually a severe tooth infection that they actually pulled in the emergency, urgent care. They pulled it, the whole root out, okay? And
right.
And so I do have a biological dentist. I don't know. She's not too very different, okay? But she's going to tell me if the condition of the rest of my mouth and my bones. And I got this fear here about that because losing one tooth just was, it was rough because it's a front tooth. And I want to experience that she's going to say, your bones are good. We can put an implant in that one tooth and all your other teeth are, you know, there is issues in my other teeth. And I feel like I'm bracing for the bad news, but I want to do like energy work on me to let that go. But I wanted to say all this because I would love for her to know your work. That's all I can say, but she doesn't. So she can understand that as I do this work, my bones will get stronger. And I do have hope for if I'm losing a tooth or two teeth or whatever, that I can. I don't even know if I should get implants because I've got this thing inside of me that's like, that my body's not going to like that because it's not natural. So I want to have a natural path, and I figured that you brought that up in the earlier radio show. This guy that's doing work with Jeannie worked with Michael, with you. I'm sorry, I was reading my notes. And if maybe he could recommend somebody for me. I don't know. I don't know how to find someone that knows your work.
You mean in the somebody that's in the field of dentistry?
That would be nice, but I don't even have a regular doctor. I haven't had one. I was a raw food vegan 100% since I was 37 years old. I never got sick. And so, you know, my teeth, though, was the things that have gotten that whole store, my gums, that stores, the disease energy. I don't know. I'm not expecting that you know somebody, but I just wanted to say that is what I'm putting out into the universe, that I would like some medical person who heals using your work issues like this.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I don't know anybody out in that direction, so I guess mm-hmm. I can't give you a recommendation, but we'll certainly hold the space that the right
sure.
person shows up. There are a lot of alternative physicians out there today that have tremendous awareness of the healing process.
As a matter of fact, what's coming up for me is the dentist that I have. She's very, very different, and she's a non-intrusive person, but I can tell her that whatever the results are, I'm going to work on it with the work that you have, that you're doing. I'm going to work on it with her with this work.
Right.
I guess I can say that my cells will regenerate because she sent me to a stem cell person. She wasn't the urgent care person. I went to her for the first time afterwards. And she said, go to the stem cell guy. He puts these stem cell machines on your around your bones of your where they pulled the tooth. So we hope we can stem cell. I don't know what it is. Can help in regrowing it. So we can see, as I will find out tomorrow, if it's helping grow the bone back around it. But she's open enough about that, and I don't know much about stem cells or all that, but I do think she's open enough to hear me say that I want to remove the disease energy of all the
right.
disease energy and remove them from my cells. And it is a bone thing that you talked about. You even have some radio show that says it's in the bones or something.
Yeah.
So would that help if I listen to that? Because this is about bones.
Yeah. You know, standing in the willingness to embrace anything, you know, there's the show I think you're talking about is one where I talk about embracing that which has been locked in bone. And you look at,
yes.
you know, the way people clench their jaws. And what
yes.
are they clenching their jaws against and about? And it's that fear state, that sympathetic state we talked about last week. And remember, as you're going through this, to keep doing that exercise, to move from, you know, and do it regularly and often, to move from that sympathetic dominant state before the fear has a hold, the nervous system is in the grip of fear, and move into that parasympathetic dominant state where the nervous system is open and able to thrive and able to flow. And that's going to create more regeneration than anything else. And your willingness to embrace whatever you've locked in. And of course, how many generations, you know, when you share what went on with your mom and dad, I bet there was a whole lot of jaw clenching in their lives. And
oh my gosh,
you know,
yes.
you can probably presume grandparents and their grandparents. How long has this been going on? I know there was a particular breath session, still point session that I was doing, and I was directed to stand in the willingness to embrace what had been locked in bone. And I was literally shown just this, I don't even know how to describe it. It was just this unfathomable number of people in my personal bloodline who had locked jaws, locked fists, locked gut. And the request was for me to be willing to unlock and embrace all of that energy. And what I was shown was just this incalculable number of people in my own personal bloodline that's where they lived. And so you, as the early adopter in your family, are going to get the opportunity to open until you're literally being able to embrace and process generations and generations of that energy that there's been resistance against. And,
yeah.
you know, it's interesting in the Aramaic language, there's a conversation supposedly about this creature, this evil dude named Satan. And in Aramaic, that word Satan means the resistor, one who misleads. When we go into resistance, when we go into holding on, when we go into a clenched fist or a clenched jaw, then we're locking down the flow of energy that's meant to move through our cells. And human life is the flow of love through our cellular structure. But when we lock that down, we inhibit human life. We stop the flow of love through our structure, and we replace it with that which we're clenching our jaw against. And as you process that energy out, as you stand in the space and the willingness to be empowered to embrace those generational patterns, then as you let loose and you move out of that resistance, in Aramaic, the word Satan means the resistor, one who misleads. So when we're in that resistance state, the mind has always got a story about how the problem's somebody else. And to let go of being misled and recognize, you know, my jaw is clenched because there's something I don't want to deal with. And when I breathe and I let go of that resistance, I let go of my story, I'm literally letting go of being trapped in Satan in the Aramaic sense. So it's much more imminent than this dude with the red suit, the tail and the pitchfork that's supposedly out there somewhere on the earth running around and out to get us. It's an internal process, and that's all a projection. You know, if you look at it, this, there's a passage in the scriptures where they talk about, you know, it says the Creator came together with Satan, and you know, the Creator says to Satan, "Satan, from whence come you?" And here's the reply. Satan says, "From going to and fro upon the earth, from going back and forth upon it." Now, what is to and fro, back and forth, but a statement of our past? And that past, the unresolved issues, form the story that we use to pretend that it's not about us. And when somebody says that's about you, I mean, think back all those years ago when you came to that mini workshop that I did, and you took a piece of the work and you went to work with it, but how much resistance was there to being fully responsible? And now look, you've done the work of overcoming the resistance. You're going, yeah, I'm ready to go for it. I'm ready to get out of the clutches of Satan, the resistor, being misled by my own mind, from my own going to and fro upon the earth. I'm going to let go of my past. I'm going to forgive my past and step into the present. And to remember that you're literally doing that, you know, the Native Americans have a wonderful saying, and the words are metaquiasin. And metaquiasin means for all my relations. I'm not just doing this for me, but for everybody in my bloodline.
Yeah, okay. So what was the exercise you said? I have to listen to this, but as I keep doing the exercise, what is the, is this the connected breathing exercise? What exercise?
Well, the connected breathing ties in, but remember we talked about when you're in that sympathetic dominant state, fear's got a hold of you. There's a simple thing you can do where you take your right hand
and
put it up over your shoulder on the left side of your head, and you pull your head down toward your right shoulder.
Yes.
You look up and to the left. So when you're going to the right shoulder, with your eyes, you look up high and to the left as though you're looking, trying to look through the top of your head to the left, and you breathe. And you just let your breath expand through your chest and down through your abdomen all the way to your pelvis. So that's one side. And then you go to the other side. You take your left hand, put it up over on the right side of your head, just above your ear. Pull your head down towards your shoulder. Look, now that you're over on the left side, you're looking up now and to the right. You point your eyes as tight and as far up to the right as you can while you hold your head down towards your shoulder. And once again, you breathe deeply and let everything stretch. And that's moving that helps you physiologically to move from what they call a sympathetic dominant state, the fear, fright, freeze state, into the parasympathetic dominant state. It stretches what's called the vagus nerve, and that's what innervates all of the organs in the body. And when it's shut down, we're in a decay state.
Yeah.
But we're on guard to protect ourselves, so it's a protection state. That when there's real danger, you want to be in that state. You want to be ready, you know, to fight or run.
Yeah.
And when you look around the room and you go, well, I can look in every corner of the room. There's nothing here to get me, but my body's still in that fright, fight, fear, flee mode. Then I can use that exercise to gently open and start to shift my physiology into the parasympathetic dominant, which is thrive state, which is rest, digest, and heal.
Okay.
So just keep, you know, those two things in mind, along with, you know, on the physiological level, along with the forgiveness work, and that is the still point breathing and that simple exercise to move from sympathetic to parasympathetic.
Okay. And one other question I was, before your connected breathing thing, I gave up on it, but I was like trying to do the breath of fire, which I think is some yoga thing where like a dog, actually, it sounds like. But anyway, is that any way related to still point breathing or connected breathing?
No.
Okay.
No, if somebody starts to do that fast panting breath, I mean, that's a great way to get yourself into trauma and get a lot of energy moving, but it's not very healing.
Gets you into
trauma? I suggest
trauma?
That you, pardon me?
It gets you into trauma?
Oh, yeah, that can stir up a lot of trauma. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, okay, not off my list.
So, again, you know, the breathing structure is connected to this, you know, we've got this nervous system that on one side, on one end, it's a continuum. It's not either or, it's a continuum. On one side, it's sympathetic dominant, fear, fight, fright, flee, freeze. On the other side, it's parasympathetic dominant. And you want to keep a balance. And when you start doing, you can stir the system up into a lot of trauma. Where with the still point breathing process, it's a gentle, easy, we're not looking to stir up trauma. We're looking to open the breath and move into the parasympathetic dominant state where there's aliveness, there's energy flow, and there's the ability to thrive.
Okay, I can hear the difference. Okay. All righty. Well,
cool.
I'm glad I asked.
I'm glad you asked, too, because this will serve absolutely everybody. So I'm delighted that you're as willing as you are and that you're here with your questions, and we invite you to keep coming back with them. You know, everybody in the community moves forward with your work.
Thank you. I'm moving forward. So.
Honored. Awesome.
Cecilia?
Yeah?
I forwarded an email to you the other day from Roma where she actually wrote the lyrics to a song.
Yes. I wrote her back because her email address was on there. Okay. I don't know if you knew that. Did she know? I told her, I said it touched my heart very deeply. I'm going to put it in a frame so I can see it every day. And I'll hold a space of love for her too. And I thank her for holding that for me. And she wrote back and she said, sing it to the God Bless America. I guess the melody of God Bless America, not the words.
Awesome.
So I have,
yeah.
Right.
God Bless America is like an intensely song that you really have to be like really trained to be able to really pull it off. But I was like, okay, I'm putting this song on my list. Okay. So I haven't gotten time to just even just for fun doing it yet, but I will. Yeah,
sweet.
So.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
Maybe you'll record it and send us a copy. there's a challenge.
That is a challenge. Let me do my parasympathetic exercise in my mind. Okay.
I love it.
Okay.
You're really catching on, young lady. That's awesome.
Oh, awesome. Also, I was live watching every trailer known to mankind of this movie, Aretha Franklin, Respect. And you can watch every trailer, but I don't think you have to go to the movies because there's so many different ones. Anyway, I decided to go back and sing these songs of hers, and I thought, I don't even like it when I change the lyrics to it, you know, because I just don't feel the same about it. So for my voice coach has me do, and he had to, I came into him screaming. I was a screamer as a singer, right? I mean, at that time, because I was so afraid, okay? So I had to learn to get control of my voice. And he told me this story. He said that there's this one vocalist. I can't think of her name right now, but she was in she was hit by a semi, and she lost the ability to do something. And he said, so she decided to start singing, and singing really easy songs that relaxed her and relaxed her nervous system. And she said, so I heard your story. I lost half of my face when I was 21 in a car accident. And he's got, and of course I had a plastic surgery put on it. And he said, so don't you think you might want to just try songs that calm you instead of these screamer songs? And I was really resistant to it. I thought, no, I like these really on fire songs. And it took me a year to just eventually get used to these easier song, like Alanis Morissette sings it in her easy voice. She is also a screamer. But she, and I don't mean in a negative way, screamer. I think she just puts herself out there a lot. But with the song Madness, she's got a very breathy sound. And it just comes out, and it's really, you know, easy. You can hear the breath through it. And so I'm like, I tried to sing Aretha, and I'm like, I can't sing this again because I like it. I like their breathiness, not the breathy. I like hearing the breath and the tone and being calm with the certain songs that I sing. That I don't know if I want to go back to Aretha is my point because of
Yeah. And what we do is we tend to be attracted to what matches the state of our nervous system.
I can tell them that.
And, you know, in relationships, we call that building relationships on matching bags of garbage.
Yeah.
We
okay.
look for the person who knows how to resonate that part in us. And in terms of the music, you know, basically looking for that screaming music is because it was screaming in your nervous system. Now that you're processing that out, your nervous system's coming to a calmer space, you can go to something calmer, and then you'll get to the point where your nervous system will function totally and thrive, and you won't have any, even the slightest attraction to that drama and trauma game anymore. That will just disappear.
Yep.
That's how it works. So nice work. That's awesome.
Okay. So there you go. I'm going to go, and I'm going to, just live, breathe, and love life.
There you go. I'm going to send you, because it'll be good for a laugh. There's a particular song that a little girl does on America's Got Talent that is the extreme. Jeannie, you know the one I'm talking about, the extreme of screaming. And you'll get a laugh out of it because you'll probably see yourself in earlier times when you look at this song. I'll send you a link to it.
I used to scream all the time when I sang. I just screamed at the top of my lungs.
Well, that's the state of the nervous system. So.
Wow.
Nice work.
I like calming stuff. I like actually feeling my breath when I sing and talk. That's always nice to do.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, nice work, young lady.
Thank you. Talk to you guys later.
All right. Okay, take care. Blessings. Bye-bye. Sweet. What a great example for everybody. Yeah. Healing is an awesome, awesome thing. And so, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody else in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
No, it is still all quiet, and it's not coincidental, but amazing. I just happened to turn around. I heard a noise, and I turned around and looked behind me, and, you know, we've hung pictures up that we brought back from Heartland, and there is that picture of the it's Leo Hahn. And she paints ancestral pictures. So there's this canoe with the Indian in the canoe, and he's like exhausted from paddling, and he's like leaning, slumped over, and then kind of really faint, almost ghostly, is two ancestors that are paddling for him. So it's like the same, you know, that I was tired in the car.
Exactly.
And someone else. Yeah. So.
We have that
ancestral
energy for support.
Yeah.
The man who invented the Salk vaccine, Jonas Salk, I think far more important than the Salk vaccine, he said, the most important thing we can be is a good ancestor. And when we step into that space of support and healing and the willingness to embrace for all my relations, for all my generations, past, present, and future, you know, to me, that is stepping into the Garden of Gethsemane with Yeshua, where they say he took on the sins of the world. And what that means energetically is that he became the space of love to hold the space to process everything that he had not resolved, and to be willing to be the space to open that for all of our relations, for all of our generations. And we can each do that, and it's pretty awesome to consciously do that purposely in this life today. So that's an invitation to step into being a good ancestor. And our calling number, if you're on one of those stations we can't see you at, is 563-999-3581. We've got about 9 minutes, so if you're out there in listener land, has this stimulated anything for you? Has this resonated anything for you? Anything that you need to look at? Anything you need support with? If you push one, we'll be having a conversation. How can we support you? What's on your mind? And if there are no hands up, Miss Jeannie, I think that especially since we started the show early today, we can bring the show to a close and just say thank you, everybody, for joining us. And be a good ancestor. Create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.